Chapter 24. The Negro Riots of 1712-1741. Almost impossible for the present generation to comprehend its true character and effect on the people. Description of New York at that time. The Negro Slaves. The Negro Riot of 1712. Description of it. The winter of 1741. Governor's house burned down. Other fires. Suspicion of the people. Arrest and imprisonment of the blacks. Reward offered for the supposed conspirators. Alarm and flight of the inhabitants. Examination and confession of Mary Burton. Peggy, the Newfoundland beauty, and the Hewson family. The conspiracy. Executions. Fast. Hewson's hearing. Hung in chains. The body, and that of a Negro, left to swing and rot in the air. Strange change in the appearances of the bodies. The people thronged to look at them. Negroes burned at the stake. Terrific spectacle. Bloody summer. Execution of a Catholic priest. Strange scenes. Upper classes accused. Execution stopped. Reason of the panic. Probably no event of comparatively modern times, certainly none in our history, has occurred so extraordinary in some of its phases as the Negro Riot of 1741. We cannot fully appreciate it, not merely because of the incompleteness of some of its details, nor from the lapse of time, but because of our inability to place ourselves in the position or state of mind of the inhabitants of New York City at that period. We can no more throw ourselves into the social condition and feel the influences of that time than we can conceive the outward physical appearance of the embryo metropolis. It is impossible to stand amid the whirl and uproar of New York today and imagine men plowing and sowing grain and carting hay into barns where the city hall now stands. The conception of nearly all the city lying below the park, above its farms to Canal Street, beyond that clearings where men are burning brush and logs to clear away the fallow, and still farther on, towards Central Park, an unbroken wilderness, is so dim and shadowy that we can hardly fix its outlines. Yet it was so in 1741. Where now stands the tombs, and cluster the crowded tenements of Five Points, was a pond or lakelet, nearly 2 miles in circumference and 50 feet deep, and encircled by a dense forest. Its deep, sluggish outlet into the Hudson is now Canal Street. In wet weather there was another water communication with the East River, near Peck Slip, cutting off the lower part of the island, leaving another island, containing some 800 acres. Through Broad Street, along which now rolls each day the stream of business, and swells the tumult of the broker's board, then swept a deep stream, up which boatmen rowed their boats to sell oysters. The water that supplied these streams and ponds is now carried off through immense sewers, deep underground, over which the unconscious population tread. Where Front and Water streets on the east side, and West Greenwich and Washington on the west side, now stretch, were then the East and Hudson rivers, having smooth and pebbly beaches. There was not a single sidewalk in all the city, and only some half dozen paved streets. On the Battery stood the fort, in which were the governor's and secretary's houses, and over which floated the British flag. But all this outward appearance is no more unlike the New York of today than its internal condition. The population numbered only about 10,000, one-fifth of which was Negroes, who were slaves. Their education being wholly neglected, they were ignorant and debased, and addicted to almost every vice. They were, besides, restive under their bondage amid the severe punishments often inflicted on them, which caused their masters a great deal of anxiety. Not isolated as an inland plantation, but packed in a narrow space, they had easy communication with each other, and worse than all, with the reckless and depraved crews of the vessels that came into port. It is true, the most stringent measures were adopted to prevent them from assembling together. Yet, in spite of every precaution, there would now and then come to light some plan or project that would fill the whites with alarm. They felt half the time as though walking on the crust of a volcano, and hence were in a state of mind to exaggerate every danger and give credit to every sinister rumor. The experience of the past, as well as the present state of feeling among the slaves, justified this anxiety and dread, for only 30 years before occurred just such an outbreak as they now feared. On the 7th of April, in 1712, between 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, the house of Peter Van Tilburg was set on fire by Negroes, which was evidently meant as a signal for a general revolt. The cry of fire roused the neighboring inhabitants, and they rushed out through the unpaved muddy streets toward the blazing building. As they approached it, they saw, to their amazement, in the red light of the flames, a band of Negroes standing in front, armed with guns and long knives. Before the whites could hardly comprehend what the strange apparition meant, the Negroes fired, and then rushed on them with their knives, killing several on the spot. The rest, leaving the building to the mercy of the flames, ran to the fort on the battery, and roused the governor. Springing from his bed, he rushed out and ordered a cannon to be fired from the ramparts to alarm the town. As the heavy report boomed over the bay and shook the buildings of the town, the inhabitants leaped from their beds and, looking out of the windows, saw the sky lurid with flames. Their dread and uncertainty were increased when they heard the heavy splash of soldiers through the mud, and the next moment saw their bayonets gleam out of the gloom as they hurried forward towards the fire. In the meantime, other Negroes had rushed to the spot, so that soon there were assembled, in proportion to the white population, what in the present population of the city would be fully 10,000 Negroes. The rioters stood firm till they saw the bayonets flashing in the firelight, and then, giving one volley, fled into the darkness northward, towards what is now Wall Street. The scattered inhabitants they met, who, roused by the cannon, were hastening to the fire, they attacked with their knives, killing and wounding several. The soldiers, firing at random into the darkness, followed after them, accompanied by a crowd of people. The Negroes made for the woods and swamps near where the park now stands, and disappearing in the heavy shadows of the forest, were lost to view. Knowing it would be vain to follow them into the thickets, the soldiers and inhabitants surrounded them and kept watch till morning. Many, of course, got off and buried themselves in the deeper, more extensive woods near Canal Street, but many others were taken prisoners. Some, finding themselves closely pressed and all avenues of escape cut off, deliberately shot themselves, preferring such a death to the one they knew awaited them. How many were killed and captured during the morning, the historian does not tell us. We can only infer that the number must have been great, from the statement he incidentally makes, that during the day 19 more were taken, tried, and executed, some that turned state's evidence were transported. 8 or 10 whites had been murdered, and many more wounded. It was a terrible event, and remembered by the present inhabitants with horror and dismay. To the little handful occupying the point of the island, it was a tragedy as great as a riot in New York today would be, in which was a loss of 5,000 or more on each side. Many middle-aged men, in 1741, were young men at that time, and remembered the fearful excitement that prevailed, and it was a common topic of conversation. The state of things, therefore, which we have described, was natural. This was rendered worse by the arrival, in the winter of 1741, of a Spanish vessel, which had been captured as a prize, the crew of which was composed in part of Negroes, who were sold at auction as slaves. These became very intractable, and in spite of the floggings they received, uttered threats that they knew would reach their master's ears. Still, no evidence of any general plot against the inhabitants was suspected, and things were moving on in their usual way, when, on the 18th of March, a wild and blustering day, the governor's house in the fort was discovered to be on fire. fanned by a fierce southeast wind, the flames spread to the king's chapel, the secretary's house, barracks, and stables, and in spite of all efforts to save them, were totally consumed. The origin of the fire was supposed to be accidental, but a few days after, Captain Warren's house, near the fort, was found to be on fire. 2 or 3 days later, the storehouse of Mr. Van Zandt was discovered on fire. Still, no general suspicions were aroused. 3 more days passed, when a cow stall was reported on fire, and a few hours later, the house of Mr. Thompson. The fire in the latter case originating in the room where a Negro slave slept. The very next day, live coals were discovered under the stable of John Murray, on Broadway. This, evidently, was no accident, but the result of design, and the people began to be alarmed. The day following, the house of a sergeant near the fort was seen to be on fire, and soon after, flames arose from the roof of a dwelling near the Fly Market. The rumor now spread like wildfire through the town that it was the work of incendiaries. It seems to us a small foundation to base such a belief on, but it must be remembered that the public mind was in a state to believe almost anything. The alarm was increased by the statement of Mrs. Earle, who said that on Sunday, as she was looking out of her window, she saw 3 Negroes swaggering up Broadway, engaged in earnest conversation. Suddenly she heard one of them exclaim, "Fire! Fire! Scorch! Scorch! A little D and by," and then throwing up his hands, laughed heartily. Coupled with the numerous fires that had occurred, and the rumors afloat, it at once excited her suspicions that this conversation had something to do with a plot to burn the city. She therefore immediately reported it to an alderman, and he, next day, to the justices. Although the number of buildings thus mysteriously set on fire was, in reality, small, yet it was as great in proportion to the town then, as 300 would be in New York today. Less than that number, we imagine, would create a panic in the city, especially if the public mind was in a feverish state, as, for instance, during the recent Civil War. Some thought the Spanish Negroes had set the buildings on fire from revenge, especially as those of the government were the first to suffer. Others declared that it was a plot of the entire Negro population to burn down the city. This belief was strengthened by the fact that, in one of the last fires, a slave of one of the most prominent citizens was seen to leap from the window and make off over garden fences. A shout was immediately raised by the spectators, and a pursuit commenced. The terrified fugitive made desperate efforts to escape, but being overtaken, he was seized, and, pale as death, lifted on men's shoulders and carried to jail. Added to all this, men now remembered it lacked but a few days of being the anniversary of the bloody riot of 30 years ago. They began to watch and question the Negroes, and one of the Spanish sailors, on being interrogated, gave such unsatisfactory, suspicious answers that the whole crew were arrested and thrown into prison. But that same afternoon, while the magistrates, whom the alarming state of things had called together, were in consultation about it, the cry of fire again startled the entire community. The ringing of the alarm bell had now become almost as terrifying as the sound of the last trumpet, and the panic became general. The first step was to ascertain if there were any strangers in town who might be concealed enemies, and a thorough search was made, the militia being ordered out, and sentries posted at the ends of all the streets, with orders to stop all persons carrying bags and bundles. This was done on the 13th of April. None being found, the conclusion became inevitable that some dark, mysterious plot lay at the bottom of it all, and the inhabitants thought the city was doomed, like Sodom. First, the more timorous packed up their valuable articles and fled into the country, up toward Canal Street. This increased the panic, which swelled until almost the entire population were seen hurrying through the streets, fleeing for their lives. The announcement of an approaching army would not have created a greater stampede. Every car and vehicle that could be found was engaged at any price, into which whole families were piled, and hurried away to the farms beyond Chambers Street, in the neighborhood of Canal Street. It was a strange spectacle, and the farmers could hardly believe their senses, at this sudden inundation into their quiet houses of the people of the city. The town authorities were also swept away in the general excitement, and Negroes of all ages and sexes were arrested by the wholesale, and hurried to prison. The Supreme Court was to sit in the latter part of April, and the interval of a few days was spent in efforts to get at the guilty parties. But nothing definite could be ascertained, as the conspirators, whoever they were, kept their own secret. At length, despairing of getting at the truth in any other way, the authorities offered a reward of £100, and a full pardon to anyone who would turn state's evidence, and reveal the names of the ringleaders. This was pretty sure to bring out the facts, if there were any to disclose, and almost equally sure to obtain a fabricated story, if there was nothing to tell. A poor, ignorant slave, shaking with terror in his cell, would hardly be proof against such an inducement as a free pardon, and to him or her an almost fabulous sum of money, if he had anything to reveal, while the temptation to invent a tale that would secure both liberty and money was equally strong. On the 21st of April the court met, Judges Phillips and Horsemonger presiding. A jury was impaneled, but although there was no lack of prisoners, there was almost a total want of evidence sufficient to put a single man on trial. The reward offered had not borne its legitimate fruits, and no one offered to make any revelations. Among the first brought up for examination was Mary Burton, a colored servant girl, belonging to John Hewson, the keeper of a low, dirty Negro tavern over on the west side of the city, near the Hudson River. This was a place of rendezvous for the worst Negroes of the town, and from some hints that Mary had dropped, it was suspected it had been the headquarters of the conspirators. But when, brought before the grand jury, she refused to be sworn. They entreated her to take the oath, and tell the whole truth, but she only shook her head. They then threatened her, but with no better success. They promised she should be protected from danger and shielded from prosecution, but she still maintained an obstinate silence. They then showed her the reward, and attempted to bribe her with the wealth in store for her, but she almost spat on it in her scorn. This poor Negro slave showed an independence and stubbornness in the presence of the jury that astonished them. Finding all their efforts vain, they ordered her to be sent to jail. This terrified her, and she consented to be sworn. But after taking the oath, she refused to say anything about the fire. A theft had been traced to Houston, and she told all she knew about that, but about the fires, would neither deny nor affirm anything. They then appealed to her conscience, painted before her the terrors of the final judgment, and the torments of hell, till at last she broke down, and proposed to make a clean breast of it. She commenced by saying that Houston had threatened to take her life if she told, and then again hesitated. But at length, by persistent efforts, the following facts were wrenched from her by piecemeal. She said that three Negroes giving their names had been in the habit of meeting at the tavern, and talking about burning of the fort and city and murdering the people, and that Houston and his wife had promised to help them. After which Houston was to be governor and Cuff Phillips king. That the first part of the story was true, there is little doubt. How much, with the imagination and love of the marvelous peculiar to her race, she added to it, it is not easy to say. She said, moreover, that but one white person beside her master and mistress was in the conspiracy, and that was an Irish girl known as Peggy, the Newfoundland beauty. As he had several aliases, and was an abandoned character, being a prostitute to the Negroes, and at this time kept as a mistress by a bold, desperate Negro named Caesar. This revelation of Mary's fell on the grand jury like a bombshell. The long-sought secret they now felt was out. They immediately informed the magistrates. Of course, the greatest excitement followed. Peggy was next examined, But she denied Mary Burton's story in toto, swore that she knew nothing of any conspiracy or of the burning of the stores, that if she should accuse anyone it would be a lie and blacken her own soul. It is rather a severe reflection on the courts of justice of that period, or we might rather say, perhaps, a striking illustration of the madness that had seized on all, that although the law strictly forbade any slave to testify in a court of justice against a white person, yet this girl Mary Burton was not only allowed to appear as evidence against Peggy, but her oath was permitted to outweigh hers and cause her to be sentenced to death. The latter, though an abandoned, desperate character, was seized with terror at the near approach of death, and begged to be allowed another examination, which was granted, and she professed to make a full confession. It is a little singular that while she corroborated Mary Burton's statement as to the existence of a conspiracy, she located the seat of it not in Hewson's tavern, but in a miserable shanty near the Battery, kept by John Rom, who, she said, had promised to carry them all to a new country and give them their liberty if they would murder the whites and bring him the plunder. Like Mary Burton's confession, if truthful at all, it evidently had a large mixture of falsehood in it. On Saturday, May 9th, Peggy was again brought in and underwent a searching examination. Some of her statements seemed improbable, and they therefore tested them in every possible way. It lasted for several hours, and resulted in a long detailed confession, in which she asserted, among other things, that it was the same plot that failed in 1712, when the Negroes designed to kill all the whites, in fact, exterminate them from the island. She implicated a great many Negroes in the conspiracy, and everyone that she accused, as they were brought before her, she identified as being present at the meetings of the conspirators in Rom's house. The court seemed anxious to avoid any collusion between the prisoners, and therefore kept them apart, so that each story should rest on its own basis. By this course they thought they would be able to distinguish what was true and what was false. Either from conscious guilt, or from having got some inkling of the charge to be brought against him, Rom fled before he could be arrested. His wife, however, and the Negroes whose names Peggy gave, were sent to jail. On the 11th of May, or 20 days after the court convened, the executions commenced. On this day, Caesar and Prince, two of the three Negroes Mary Burton testified against, were hung, though not for the conspiracy, but for theft. They were abandoned men, and died recklessly. Peggy and Hewson and his wife were next condemned. The former, finding that her confession did not, as had been promised, secure her pardon, retracted all as he had said, and exculpated entirely the parties whose arrests he had caused. An atmosphere of gloom now rested over the city. Every face showed signs of dread. In this state of feeling, the lieutenant governor issued a proclamation, appointing a day of fasting and humiliation, not only in view of this calamity, but on account also of the want and loss caused by the past severe winter, and the declaration of war by England against Spain. When the day arrived, every shop was closed, and business of all kinds suspended, and the silence and repose of the Sabbath rested on the entire community. Without regard to sect, all repaired to the places of worship, where the services were performed amid the deepest solemnity. The day of execution appointed for Hewson, his wife, and Peggy was a solemn one, and almost the entire population turned out to witness it. The former had declared that some extraordinary appearance would take place at his execution, and everyone gazed on him as he passed in a cart from the prison to the gallows. He was a tall, powerful man, being 6 feet high. He stood erect in the cart all the way, his piercing eye fixed steadily on the distance, and his right hand raised high as his fetters would permit, and beckoning as though he saw help coming from afar. His face was usually pale and colorless, but today it was noticed that two bright red spots burned on either cheek, which added to the mystery with which the superstitious spectators invested him. When the sad procession arrived at the place of execution, the prisoners were helped to the ground and stood exposed to the gaze of the crowd. Hewson was firm and self-possessed, but Peggy, pale and weeping and terror-struck, begging for life, while the wife, with the rope round her neck, leaned against a tree, silent and composed, but colorless as marble. One after another they were launched into eternity, and the crowd, solemn and thoughtful, turned their steps homeward. Hewson was hung in chains, and in a few days a Negro was placed beside him, and here they swung, blind and blackening, in the April air, in full view of the tranquil bay, a ghastly spectacle to the fishermen as they plied their vocation nearby. For 3 weeks they dangled here in sunshine and storm, a terror to the passers-by. At length a rumor passed through the town that Hewson had turned into a Negro, and the Negro into a white man. This was a new mystery, and day after day crowds would come and gaze on the strange transformation, some thinking it supernatural, and others trying to give an explanation. Hewson had threatened to take poison, and it was thought by many that he had, and it was the effect of this that had wrought the change in his appearance. For 10 days the battery was thronged with spectators, gazing on these bloated, decomposing bodies, many in their superstitious fears expecting some new transformation. Under the increasing heat of the sun, they soon began to drip, till at last the body of Hewson burst asunder, filling the air with such an intolerable stench that the fishermen shunned the locality. As simple hanging was soon thought not sufficient punishment, and they were left to swing and slowly rot in chains, so this last was at length thought to be too lenient, and the convicts were condemned to be burned at the stake. Two Negroes, named Quack and Cuffy, were the first doomed to this horrible death. The announcement of this sentence created the greatest excitement. It was a new thing to the colonists, this mode of torture being appropriated by the savages for prisoners taken in war. Curious crowds gathered to see the stake erected, or stare at the loads of wood as they passed along the street, and were unloaded at its base. It was a strange spectacle to behold the workmen carefully piling up the faggots under the spring sun, the spectators looking on, some horrified, and others fierce as savages, and over all the blue sky bending, while the gentle wind stole up from the bay and whispered in the treetops overhead. On the day of execution an immense crowd assembled. The two Negroes were brought forward, pale and terrified, and bound to the stake. As the men approached with the fire to kindle the pile, they shrieked out in terror, confessed the conspiracy, and promised, if released, to tell all about it. They were at once taken down. This was the signal for an outbreak, and shouts of "Burnham, Burnham!" burst from the multitude. Mr. Moore then asked the sheriff to delay execution till he could see the governor and get a reprieve. He hurried off, and soon returned with a conditional one. But, as he met the sheriff on the common, the latter told him that it would be impossible to take the criminals through the crowd without a strong guard, and before that could arrive, they would be murdered by the exasperated populace. They were then tied up again, and the torch applied. The flames arose around the unhappy victims. The curling smoke soon hid their dusky forms from view, while their shrieks and cries for mercy grew fainter and fainter, as the fierce fire shriveled up their forms, till at last nothing but the crackling of the flames was heard, and the shouting, savage crowd grew still. As the fire subsided, the two wretched creatures, crisped to a cinder, remained to tell, for the 100th time, to what barbarous deeds terror and passion may lead men. Some of the Negroes went laughing to the place of execution, indulging in all sorts of buffoonery to the last, and mocking the crowd which surrounded them. All protested their innocence to the last, and if they had confessed previously, retracted before death their statements and accusations. But this contradiction of themselves, tomorrow denying what the day they had solemnly sworn on the Bible to be true, instead of causing the authorities to hesitate, and consider how much terror and the hope of pardon had to do with it, convinced them still more of the strength and dangerous nature of the conspiracy, and they went to work with a determination and recklessness which made that summer the bloodiest and most terrific in the annals of New York. No lawyer was found bold enough to step forward and defend these poor wretches, but all volunteered their services to aid the government in bringing them to punishment. The weeks now, as they rolled on, were freighted with terror and death, and stamped with scenes that made the blood run cold. This little town, on the southern part of Manhattan Isle, and was wholly given to panic, and a nameless dread of some mysterious, awful fate, extended even to the scattered farmhouses near Canal Street. Between this and the last of August, 154 Negroes, exclusive of whites, were thrown into prison, till every cell was crowded and packed to suffocation with them. For 3 months, sentence of condemnation was on an average of one a day. The last execution was that of a Catholic priest, or rather of a schoolmaster of the city, who was charged with being one. Mary Burton, after an interval of 3 months, pretended to remember that he was present with the other conspirators as he had first named as being in Hewson's tavern. His trial was long, and apparently without excitement. He conducted his own case with great ability, and brought many witnesses, to prove his good character and orderly conduct. But he, of course, could not disprove the assertion of Mary, that as he had some time, or other seen him with the conspirators at Hewson's tavern for the latter, with his wife and Peggy, and the Negroes as he had before named, had all been executed. Mary Burton alone was left, and her evidence being credited, no amount of testimony could avail him. Although the proceedings were all dignified and solemn, as became an English court, yet the course the trial took showed how utterly unbalanced and one-sided it had become. To add weight to Mary's evidence, many witnesses were examined to prove that Urey, though a schoolmaster, had performed the duties of a Catholic priest, as though this were an important point to establish. The Attorney General, in opening the case, drew a horrible picture of former persecutions by the Papists, and their cruelties to the Protestants, until it was apparent that all that the jury needed to endorse a verdict of guilty was evidence that he was a Catholic priest. Still, it would be unfair to attribute this feeling wholly to religious intolerance or the spirit of persecution. England was at this time at war with Spain, and a report was circulated that the Spanish priests in Florida had formed a conspiracy to murder the English colonists. A letter from Oglethorpe, in Georgia, confirmed this. Urey, who was an educated Englishman, but had led an adventurous life in different countries, could not disprove this, and he was convicted and sentenced to be hung. He met his fate with great composure and dignity, asserting his innocence to the last. He made the 18th victim hung, while 13 had been burned at the stake, and 71 transported to various countries. At the average rate of 2 every week, one hanged and one burned alive, they were hurried into eternity amid prayers, and imprecations, and shrieks of agony. The hauling of wood to the stake, and the preparation of the gallows, kept the inhabitants in a state bordering on insanity. Business was suspended, and every face wore a terrified look. The voice of pity as well as justice was hushed, and one desire, that of swift vengeance, filled every heart. At the press of today, with its system of interviewing, and minuteness of detail and description, existed then, there would have been handed down to us a chapter in human history that could be paralleled only in the Dark Ages. A swift massacre, a terrible slaughter, comes and goes like an earthquake or a tornado, and stuns rather than debases. But this long, steady succession of horrible executions and frightful scenes changed the very nature of the inhabitants, and they became a prey to a spirit demoniacal rather than human. the prayers and tears of those led forth to the stake, their hair-trending cries as they were bound to it, and their shrieks of agony, that were wafted out over the still waters of the bay, fell on hard and pitiless hearts. The ashes of the wood that consumed one victim would hardly grow cold before a new fire was kindled upon them, and the charred and blackened posts stood month after month, hideous monuments of what man may become when judgment and reason are surrendered to fear and passion. The spectacle was made still more revolting by the gallows standing near the stake, on which many were hung in chains, and their bodies left to swing, blacken, and rot in the summer air, a ghastly horrible sight. Where this madness, that had swept away court, bar, and people together, would have ended, it is impossible to say, had not a new terror seized the inhabitants. Mary Burton, on whose accusation the first victims had been arrested and executed, finding herself a heroine, sought new fields in which to win notoriety. She ceased to implicate the blacks, and turned her attention to the whites, and 24 were arrested and thrown into prison. Elated with her success, she began to ascend in the social scale, incriminated some persons of the highest social standing in the city, whose characters were above suspicion. This was turning the tables on them in a manner the upper class did not expect, and they began to reflect what the end might be. The testimony that was sufficient to condemn the slaves was equally conclusive against them. The stake and the gallows which the court had erected for the black man, it could not pull down, because a white gentleman stood under their shadow. Robespierre and his friends cut off the upper crust of society without hesitation or remorse, but unfortunately the crust next below this became in turn the upper crust, which also had to be removed, until at last they themselves were reached, when they paused. They had advanced up to their necks, in the bloody tide of revolution, and finding that to proceed farther would take them overhead, they attempted to wade back to shore. So here, so long as the accusations were confined to the lowest class, it was all well enough, but when they were being reached, it was high time to stop. The proceedings were summarily brought to a close. Further, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.